press deadlines, Iran rejects U.S. allegations that an Iranian national plotted to kill former National Security Advisor John Bolton as ridiculous and politically motivated. Iran's president reiterates Tehran's opposition to any change in the Caucasus borders, saying it is ready to help establish security in that region. Also coming up, wildfires continue to burn out of control in southwestern France, forcing thousands of people to leave their homes. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran has strongly rejected U.S.'s baseless accusations against an Iranian national who has been charged with planning terrorist operations in the United States. Foreign Ministry spokesman made the remark after the U.S. Justice Department charged an Iranian with plotting to murder John Bolton, a national security advisor to former President Donald Trump. Nasser Kanani said such unfounded accusations were brought up with purely political intentions to cover up numerous terrorist crimes committed by the U.S., Israel, and their affiliated terror groups. He also issued a stern warning about any measures taken against Iranian nationals on the basis of such, quote, ridiculous accusations. Kanani said Iran reserves the right to take necessary steps within the framework of international law to defend the rights of the country's governments and nationals. Iran's president says Tehran does not accept any change in the political geography of the region and is ready to do its best to help establish peace in the Caucasus. Ibrahim Raisi made the remark in a phone call with the Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan. Raisi said observing the tripartite statement signed by the leaders of Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Russia is the best way to establish peace and security in the Caucasus. He reiterated Iran's sensitivity toward its borders with the Caucasus, stressing Tehran's opposition to any change in the regional borders. Raisi also lauded the two countries' profound historical relations, calling for increased economic cooperation between Tehran and Yerevan. The trilateral statement was signed by Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Russia in November 2020. It ended the latest bout of military conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Iran says it has relayed the messages on the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA to the United States through the European parties to the accord. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Emi Abdullahian made the remark in a phone call with his Turkish counterpart Mevlut Çavuşoğlu. The Iranian top diplomat expressed hope that the American side would take a realistic and pragmatic approach to Iran's legitimate demands to pave the way for a final agreement on the revival of the deal. Since the U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA in May 2018, the remaining parties have held several rounds of talks to revive it. A new round of talks ended on Monday, after which the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell claimed that the final text has been reached. However, an unnamed Iranian Foreign Ministry official said Tehran has conveyed its initial response and reservations on the draft text to the other sides. Syrian forces have thwarted an attack by Takfiri terrorists, killing a Daesh commander before he set off his explosive vest. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali joined us earlier to bring us up to speed on this development.
Yes, actually there were two important military and security operations in Syria today. One of them was the one you mentioned in Idlib, in which the Syrian army forces over there near Saraqib, stationed in Saraqib, were able to foil an infiltration attempt by a group of terrorists made up of 25 terrorists most of them foreigners, non-Syrians. They were trying to infiltrate from one village to another in Idlib countryside, in eastern Idlib countryside. They were trying to infiltrate from Al-Nayrab village towards Jobas village. They were trying, those terrorists, to edge closer towards the Syrian army units stationed in Saraqib, a town, a key town in Idlib, liberated by the Syrian army several years ago. And also they were trying to come closer to the main international highway that links Damascus with Aleppo over there. The Syrian army was able to foil this infiltration attempt and kill or injure most of those terrorists. Then the weapons were confiscated and the explosives that they had dismantled. There was also a very important operation that happened in southern Syria, where, according to an official security source, security forces were able to kill the commander of Daesh terrorists in southern Syria named Abu Salem al-Iraqi. What happened was that those security forces discovered that he was hiding in Tafas town in Daraa countryside, and then he was chased down after he escaped towards Idwan. There, clashes took place in which he was injured and shot by several bullets, and then Abu Salem al-Iraqi blew himself up using an explosive belt. As a result of this security operation over there, one member of the Syrian security forces was killed, and also there was a civilian taken hostage by Abu Salem al-Iraqi. He was injured during that operation.
During its recent aggression on the Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime killed dozens of civilians, including children, across the territory. The regime attacked several homes and workplaces, showing complete disregard towards the lives of Palestinians. Now many believe that Israel must be held accountable for the crimes it has committed against humanity, and we have a report on that.
Rights groups have accused the Israeli regime of committing war crimes against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip during its three-day onslaught against the territory. On Friday, Israeli forces started launching wanton attacks on Gaza, killing and maiming hundreds of civilians, including women and children. The fighting stopped on Sunday through an Egypt-mediated ceasefire. But Palestinians now have to live with the devastating aftermath of Israeli attacks. According to Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians were systematic and deliberate and fall under Israel's strategy of using disproportionate and excessive force against civilians.
Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights reiterates its strongest condemnation of Israel's gross and systematic violations of international law, particularly in cases of extrajudicial killings and attacks against civilians and civilian objects. Such violations amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity for which those responsible must be held accountable.
Five wars have been unleashed between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza since 2008. The regime has been using U.S.-made warplanes and weapons to hit targets in the densely populated area.
The United States and Israel are both responsible for the bloodshed in Gaza. Israel was given the green light from the United States to carry out the brutal attacks on Gaza under the watchful eye of the international community. Israel and the United States are partners in crime against the Palestinian people.
Human rights organizations say, based on the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, it is more than clear that Israel has been committing war crimes during its attacks on Gaza.
The impunity Israel continues to enjoy and the absence of accountability encourage Israeli officials to continue perpetuating war crimes against Palestinians. As evidenced by its latest aggression on Gaza, Israel does not hesitate to engage in prohibited acts of killing, including direct targeting of civilians. The International Criminal Court must at least investigate these crimes.
For decades now, there has been no pressure on Israel to stop its violence against civilians. Despite repeated and desperate pleas from human rights groups, the international community has stayed silent about the regime's atrocities against Palestinians.
Despite Israel's grave violations of international law, Palestinians continue to suffer due to international apathy. Now, rights groups are demanding that Israeli war criminals be brought to justice. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
London rights groups, meanwhile, including the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, the Friends of Al-Aqsa and Stop the War Coalition, have joined forces to call on the British government to stop supporting Israel in its aggression against the Palestinians. As casualties mount from the regime's latest bombardment of Gaza, demonstrators demand action from whoever takes over as the next British PM. Amina Taylor has more from the British capital.
It's scenes like these, ones of tragedy, injustice and destruction, that prompted a group of London rights organisations to call an emergency demonstration in support of Palestine and Palestinians. The Israeli bombardment of Gaza was the worst it's been since the May 2021 war that killed 260 Palestinians and destroyed thousands of homes and businesses. This new assault cost the lives of at least 47 Palestinians. A third of the scores killed were children. For those attending the demonstration opposite Downing Street, the official residence of the British Prime Minister, they needed to be present to raise their voice against the injustice.
What we've witnessed over the last few days is very familiar, but no less horrific. Once again, Israel has been bombing the Palestinian people in Gaza, claiming a right to self-defense. There's a reality here that any form of violence that is used to enforce occupation, used to enforce apartheid, used to enforce settler colonialism is by definition illegitimate. It is the Palestinian people who have a right to defense and to protect themselves.
One of the main themes linking the speakers at this event is the fact that the Israeli aggression is only made possible by the tacit support of states like the British, and that Palestinian blood remains on British hands.
The UK has obligations under international humanitarian law and the Geneva Convention to look after the people who are occupied rather than stand with the oppressor, with the world's 21st century apartheid state. They must stop. They must support the Palestinians in real terms, not through words, two-state solution, which means absolutely nothing, but in sanctioning Israel, because that's the next thing that needs to happen.
Your policy on the Palestinians has to change. Justice has to prevail. And the way the hypocrisy, the way they do deal with the Palestinian issue and other issues like the Ukrainian issues, for example, is at least we can say a hypocritical way of dealing with it. So therefore, we are here today to raise our voice and tell them that this is not acceptable.
Though a ceasefire is supposed to be in force, commentators point out that this simply means Israel has moved its campaign of aggression to other parts of occupied Palestine, including Nablus, where there have already been casualties, raising the specter of an escalation resulting in further Palestinian blood being shed. Amina Taylor, London.
Elsewhere, thousands of people have been forced to leave their homes in southwestern France as wildfires continue to burn out of control. On Wednesday, the fire destroyed many homes, forcing the evacuation of 10,000 residents from the region. Firefighters say more evacuations are likely. France is currently struggling with successive heat waves and its worst drought on record. Dozens of wildfires are ablaze across the country, including at least 8 major ones. Wildfires in France have raised more than 57,200 hectares so far this year. The figure is nearly 6 times the full year average for 2006 to 2021. The French Interior Minister says 9 out of 10 fires are either voluntarily or involuntarily caused by people. The war in Ukraine is a human tragedy that has resulted in the death of many innocent people. It also displays how there has not been enough push for diplomacy, particularly from the United States. While Russia has been described by the West as an aggressor, Ukraine too has been guilty of killing civilians. This is while the US has flooded Ukraine with lethal weapons, much of which do not even reach Ukrainian forces and goes unaccounted for.
Thank you. The war in Ukraine has caused enormous distress to the civilian population in the war-stricken areas. Ukraine and Russia have accused each other of endangering the lives of civilians. A report by Amnesty International, which is a Western rights group and is biased towards Western-style liberal democracies, has now accused Ukraine of flouting international law by exposing civilians to Russian fire. The report accuses the Ukrainian military of having established its bases in schools and hospitals. It says the Ukrainian military has launched counterattacks from heavily populated areas.
So the West is actively shaping the narrative, and it's also realizing that the narrative that the West has been provoking through Ukraine, that Ukraine has been regurgitating, is becoming increasingly seen as absolutely false. There's no facts or truth behind any of the words or the ideas or the images that the U.S. narrative has been trying to communicate. Specifically, the Russians are not losing, the Russians are not retreating.
As it was expected, the report angered Ukrainian officials. In reaction to Kiev's objection, Amnesty has issued a statement expressing its regret for the, quote, distress and anger that the report has caused amongst Ukrainian officials. Amnesty has, however, said that it stands by its findings. It has noted that the evidence it has documented does not justify, quote, Russia's violations. The blame game comes amid intensified efforts by the United States to keep the war going in East Ukraine.
Well, I think the grotesque blundering and failure of the United States in Ukraine has been ongoing for a long, long time, of course, ever since 2009 to 2019. The United States has been involved with funding illegal global viral biological chemical labs. It's been involved with training Ukrainian soldiers, inspiring them to commit acts of genocide. The U.S. has been behind all of the Ukrainian madness for a long time.
The U.S. has been the largest contributor of weapons to Ukraine by far. Ironically, other NATO members who have supplied Ukraine with weapons, like Germany, had actually purchased their weapons from American arms manufacturers. And where do those unaccounted weapons end up? According to Interpol, many will end up on the black market and in the hands of criminals. That brings an end to World Bulletin.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. The Israeli regime will continue to shed Palestinian blood for fun or for political gain or to consolidate its occupation, says Refaat Al-Arir, writer, in an article published under the heading, "Without Consequences, Israeli Regime Will Continue to Murder Palestinians." Stay tuned for more. Amal is now 2 wars old. No one ever gets used to being bombarded every year or so. The kids in particular live in constant fear. But it does become part of life. As the Israeli missiles rained down on Gaza City recently, Amal, 6, asked her mom, memories of last year's horror still fresh. Will there be another war? During the assault, the children, especially Lina, 9, and Amal, have been mostly quiet. Amal has tried to sleep and Lina lay down in the living room. At night, like most kids in Gaza, they shriek in fear each time they hear an explosion. A report published by Euromed found that about 91% of Palestinian children live in constant trauma and terror due to recurrent Israeli regime attacks. Nothing can prepare you for this. The Zionist regime has been bombarding Gaza ever since the Second Intifada. They never get used to the bombs, and they never know how to deal with the sheer terror and absolute Israeli regime savagery. No lies or hugs or sweets can calm the kids down. When the bombs fall, the kids will always shirk in utter fear. The lies that things will be all right and that these are fireworks no longer work. The Zionist regime had killed at least 30 Palestinians, including 2 Islamic Jihad leaders and a little girl, Ala Qadum, recently. Well over 250 Palestinians have been injured and several homes and buildings have been destroyed or damaged. The Zionist regime's pretext this time is as flimsy as can be. After detaining a senior Islamic Jihad leader in the occupied West Bank, the Zionist regime said it was engaged in a preemptive operation to stop alleged missile attacks before they start. This is like the Zionist regime's war on Gaza in May 2021 and its massive 2014 attack and the many escalations between them. And it brings back memories of the Israeli regime's bombing campaigns in 2012, in 2008 to 2009, 2006, and many others, several of which coincided with Israeli regime elections. Many Palestinians have seen countless of their loved ones murdered in their sleep, or when they were resting and generally minding their own business. If the Zionist regime will kill Palestinians, regardless of who they are or what they are doing, then many Palestinians believe, why not die fighting and defending their country? There is no one more determined or dangerous than a person who has nothing to lose. During the May 2021 aggression, according to Air Wars, in more than 70% of Israeli regime attacks that killed Palestinian civilians, there was no reports of any casualties from the resistance. In other words, civilians were the only victims. According to B'Tselem, an Israeli rights group, nearly two-thirds of more than 2,200 Palestinians the Zionist regime killed in Gaza in 2014 were civilians. Notice that such statistics usually count Palestinian civilian police or resistance fighters killed in their homes as they slept as militants, as they claim. Given these realities, many children, women, and the elderly are not collateral damage. Rather, they are the Zionist regime's main targets. Indeed, we understand that when the Zionist regime escalates against Palestinians, its political leaders not only receive more votes in elections, they receive more support from Western countries. With the Zionist regime's polls projecting Benjamin Netanyahu to win a majority of more than 60 seats in upcoming elections, the current interim coalition regime, considered to be moderate by many liberals in the West, must have thought a quick war on Gaza might appeal to Israeli regime's electorate. Palestinians have become accustomed to the Zionist regime's carnage when elections approach. Israeli regime leaders know the best way to win votes is to flex their muscles. Their problem, in other words, is not with Netanyahu or the Likud, but with the Israeli regime occupation itself. Yet it is wrong to assume Israeli regime kills Palestinians only when there are elections on the horizon. Israeli and Zionist militias have been massacring Palestinians for approximately 100 years now. The fake regime of Israel is not satisfied with anything but total victory for its colonial rule. Palestinians are not Ukrainians for the role to care about. They are not mostly blonde with blue eyes. They're not Jews. And for being the wrong sort of people, it seems they have to starve, to live in fear and terror, and die without any lifting a finger. The sweets and the kids' favorite pudding remain untouched. Lina and Amal cower against the walls of the living room. They refuse to eat or be entertained. There will be more Israeli regime wars and more Israeli regime massacres. Will the Zionist regime war criminals ever pay for their crimes? Will Arab countries rushing to normalize ties with the fake regime of Israel see it for what it is, an entity built on the violent dispossession and dislocation of Palestinians? Can grassroots organizations and free people, wherever there may be, put more pressure on their governments to boycott and hold the fake regime of Israel accountable? If not, the lies, little and big, will continue. The fake regime of Israel will continue to shed Palestinian blood for fun or for political gain, or to consolidate its occupation, or simply because it can.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners, my very dear sisters. Welcome to Muslim Lady. The month of Muharram is already there, so I offer my condolences to every single one of you, and of course, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. This is Asma, your humble host, and here with me, I have my very dear sister, Sister Sadiqah. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome to Muslim Lady.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Of course, Damien here. So, my dear listeners, we were discussing women and the importance of all the great ladies and the journey of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, and specifically in the history of Karbala. And we went through so much of his stuff related to Lady Zainab, salamullah alayha, and also all the women who have been participating in this history. Today, we're going to shed more of lights upon those women who had done great deal of job in this battlefield, actually. And maybe not much of us know a lot about them, but they had a great role hand in hand with Lady Zainab, salamullah alayha. So they were helping her and backing her up.
So in this segment, because we've discussed, had an overview discussion on what the role women played in the event of Ashura, if we now start to look at very zoom in onto the women themselves, so apart from Hazrat Zainab alayhi salam, we had many other women who participated in perhaps shaping the event of Ashura.
Just before you go into the depth of the story and penetrate deep into the facts that you're going to share with us, there's a quote that says, behind every successful man, there is a great woman. And I think whatever that happened to men in Ashura, for some of them, was mostly related to their women.
Exactly. And you've touched on, and I believe you're referring to the wife of Zuhair.
Exactly.
Zuhair ibn Qayn.
Exactly, yes.
So Zuhair ibn Qayn, the story goes that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was between Mecca and Kufa.
Mm-hmm.
On the way, he comes across the caravan of Zuhair ibn Qayn.
Yeah.
So Zuhair tries to distance himself from the Imam. He doesn't want to be with the Imam at this point.
Exactly. He doesn't want to meet him face to face.
No. He doesn't want to support the Imam at this point.
Yeah.
At some point, they end up camping together. So Imam Hussein sends someone to Zuhair's camp. Zuhair is with his wife. And Imam Hussein's servant goes to him and tells him, Imam Hussein wants to meet you.
Yeah.
Zuhair is very distraught at this point. He doesn't want to go.
Exactly.
His wife looks at him and tells him, what has happened to you? The son of the prophet is calling you and you're sitting here.
And whatever she told him actually changed his destiny.
Yes. So listening to his wife, he goes to Imam Hussein.
Exactly.
He meets Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein invites him to his cause.
She was his driving force.
Yes. And when he sees what Imam Hussein is doing and the reward of it in the hereafter, he goes back to his wife and tells her, I'm going with Imam Hussein and you're free to go back to your family. But when we see the role of his wife later,
she went with him.
Yeah, no, she didn't go with him. She did return back to her hometown. What did happen is that later, when the death happened, she was following the whole event. And when it did happen, she sent her servant to go cover the body of Zuhair in Karbala. Her servant goes to Karbala and he sees the body of Imam Hussein without a coffin. So he thinks to himself, how can I cover the body of Zuhair while the body of the son of the prophet is uncovered? So he goes and covers the body of Imam Hussein first.
Yes.
And he goes back to Zuhair's wife. The driving force behind Zuhair initially going towards Imam Hussein was his wife. And that is why we see a lot of times when you're looking for a spouse, you're always told, look for a spouse who's going to help you in your faith.
Exactly.
Someone who's going to be able to push you towards religion.
Strengthen your belief.
Exactly. And even if you choose to go on the wrong path, she's always going to be there to push you back.
Exactly.
And Zuhair's wife did exactly that. When she saw Zuhair was willing to go off, she pushed him towards Imam Hussein, and it ended up in him perhaps gaining one of the positions that we are told that the martyrs of Ashura will have a status so high on the Day of Judgment that all the other shuhada, all the other martyrs will be jealous of that position on the Day of Judgment.
Of course.
One position, one instance of a woman's push led to a man who perhaps would have left Imam Hussein, but he ended up being in the army of Imam Hussein.
Exactly. The story would have gone a different way.
And his destiny would have changed. But it was for his wife that he found path to his success in the hereafter.
Exactly. So just before we go into the other women, into the other great ladies that were in the story of Karbala, let's go for a little short break and we'll be back in no time. Thank you for staying tuned.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Muslim Lady. This is Arab English Radio. We're discussing great ladies who participated in the battlefield of Karbala and actually the role they shared along with their husbands to save Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So, sister, we were talking about the wife of Zuhair, and we said that she was a driving force for him to change his destiny and the story totally upside down because he was ignoring the caravan of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. But then when he was asked to go and meet Imam, it was his wife that actually motivated him to go further. So this is just one woman among all the women who shared plenty much of significance in the battlefield of Karbala.
Yes.
So let's go to the other one.
Another one that I'd like to look into is Hazrat Fidda. She was the one who had served in the household of the Prophet for a very long time. And she accompanied them according to some narrations in Karbala.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came to the court of Yazid in Damascus, modern-day Damascus, Yazid ordered the killing of Imam Sajjad, who was the only male surviving figure from the arm of Imam Hussein, yeah, alayhi salam. And obviously he was the only male surviving because he was supposed to be the Imam.
Exactly.
And when the order to kill him came about, Hazrat Zainab stood up to protect him. So they wanted to kill her as well. And this is where Hazrat Fidda stood up. And she said, if you need to kill them, you're going to kill me first. And the tribe of Hazrat Fidda stood up who were there. And they told her, if you want to kill her, you're going to have to come past us.
Very interesting.
And so her one stance...
Such great women.
This could possibly have led to her being killed.
Exactly.
But again, she realized that protecting the Imam, there is no man and woman here.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has a responsibility because this is a divine responsibility that Allah has placed on the Imam, and we have been given a responsibility to be with the Imam and protect him when needed. And this could easily have led to her murder.
Exactly.
Rather, she stood up, protected the Imam of her time, and because there was such tribalism in that time, even her tribe stood up to protect her,
mm-hmm,
which led to the Imam of the time being protected.
Now, sister, there's a question. What happens to these women to turn into these very strong characters?
Because it comes down to the upbringing they have faced, the upbringing they have gotten from a very young age.
So again, mothers are very important.
Mothers are very important. And this, if we want to see how upbringing has an effect, we go to another woman, Umm al-Banin.
Exactly.
Umm al-Banin, she's known Umm al-Banin because she had four children, four sons. All her four sons were killed in Karbala.
Yeah.
Now, Umm al-Banin was a very pious woman.
Were sacrificed for the love, yes, of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
So, Umm al-Banin was the wife of Imam Ali alayhi salam. After Hazrat Fatima died, Imam Ali was looking for a woman from a courageous tribe.
Yeah.
And so he asks his brothers, who introduces her. Now, it is said that her name was Fatima as well,
yeah,
but she never liked to be referred to as Fatima, according to what has been said, because she was afraid that the sons of Hazrat Fatima would remember their mother.
Hearing her name would, exactly, remember their mother, and then they would get sad.
Exactly. So in order to spare them that
pain, the,
exactly,
pain of the loss that they have been undertaking.
So you can see that from her onset, she knew the role that she had to play as a servant. Even when she entered the house of Imam Ali alayhi salam, she entered as a follower of the Imam, not as his wife only.
Yeah.
Even though being the wife of an Imam has a great status. When she had her children, she had four children. The most famous of them is known as Hazrat Abbas. You see, the way she nurtured them to put the Imam before themselves.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
The tribe that Umm al-Banin came from was also related to the tribe that Shimr came from. It seems that they came from the same tribe. Now, this is important because in Karbala, the night before Ashura, it's the 9th of Muharram, Shimr goes to Hazrat Abbas and his other three brothers and tells them, we're giving an amanname, which is basically we're giving
you... You're free to
treaty.
Go.
Yeah, we're giving you security. We come from the same
we're
tribe.
We're relatives.
Yeah. So we're giving you, leave the Imam and you're free to go. We won't shed your blood.
Yeah.
And this is where the tarbiyah of Imam Umm al-Banin comes in. Because exactly. She had taught them from a very young age to place the Imam before themselves, even if it comes to their life.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at them and tells them, keep your security to yourself. What do we have with this when the son of the Prophet has no security and you want to offer us security? And they're like, we don't need any security from you. We're going to stay with the son of the Prophet. And we know that the tarbiyah of Hazrat Abbas, alayhissalam, especially because his history has been focused on a lot, that in everything from a very young age, even if it came to fruits, he would look for the Imam first before himself.
Yeah. His manner is very, very much famous everywhere.
Yes, he used to place himself in anything, whether it be water, fruits, or even his life. Yeah. It was always the Imam first and me.
And that comes from the mother.
That comes from the way she brought them up from a young age.
Yeah.
To understand that the Imam is a divine leader who has been appointed by Allah and we have a responsibility to him. And that responsibility knows no boundaries. Your life, your wealth, your children
everything.
Have no value when it comes to the Imam. Because when you attach yourself to the Imam, you become the perfect human being. And we see that in Hazrat Abbas and the other women. Like even if you look
at the reflection of that.
Yes,
actually.
Even if you look at the wife of Imam Hussein, who had understood the position of the
Another
mother in Karbala. You know, her son was killed. She was a breastfeeding mother. Her son was 6 months old.
And her son was just 6 months.
Ali, but he's referred to as Ali Askar or Ali Arwadi, or some refer to him as Abdullah.
Yeah.
They're different names, but it refers to that six-month-old baby. And he takes him and tells him, if you do not want to have mercy on me, have mercy on the six-month child. So an arrow is pierced. And
those brutal creatures slaughtered that child on his father's hand.
So I've heard this from a reliable lecturer.
Yeah.
Who's also a teacher of the Hawza. And it says Rabab, who was the mother of the child, she knows the child has been killed. Now, she doesn't go to welcome the child.
Yeah.
She goes right to the end of the tent. And it says the only reason she went is that Imam Hussein does not feel any shame at that point. He has enough pain now. So you see the ma'rifah, the cognizance they had in them.
The
closeness,
insight.
That understanding they had of the Imam. It's like everyone was better than the other in this understanding.
Yes, exactly. It was like it was a competition.
Exactly. And it is, if you keep these women next to each other, you sort of fail to understand who's greater than the other.
Exactly, yeah.
Because of each one had a unique sacrifice.
Had a great sacrifice, yes. So thank you, sister. This is all the time we had for today's episode. We got familiar with so much of names of great women and ladies in the battlefield of Karbala who actually participated in that and contributed so much of things and actually had great sacrifices with their sons, with their husbands, with whatever they had in their hands. I hope you also enjoyed this session. Thank you for your attention. Until another session, I bid you farewell.
I know I'm waiting. Waiting for something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The extradition, trial, and conviction of Julian Assange would have frightening ramifications for investigative journalism, says Marjorie Kahn, journalist, in an article published under the heading "Julian Assange is enduring unbearable persecution for exposing U.S. war crimes." Stay tuned for more. Ever since UK Home Secretary Priti Patel formally ordered the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the US last week, press freedom advocates around the world have been mobilizing. Assange Defense is organizing a national and international campaign to pressure US Attorney General Merrick Garland and Joe Biden to drop the extradition request and dismiss the charges against Assange. The stakes could not be higher. The charges against Assange, including 17 under the infamous Espionage Act, could result in 175 years in prison for the journalist who exposed U.S. war crimes. Last week, Assange's brother, filmmaker Gabriel Shipton, wrote in an email to Truthout, UK Home Secretary has decided today that any publisher who exposes national security information of an allied country may face extradition to 2 lifetimes in prison. Julian will appeal this decision, and this once-in-a-lifetime fight for freedom of the press continues. Assange indictment is based on WikiLeaks' 2010 to 2011 disclosures of U.S. war crimes in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the military prison at Guantanamo. Those revelations included 400,000 field reports about the Iraq War, 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, and systematic rape, torture, and murder committed by U.S. forces, handed over detainees to a notorious Iraqi torture squad. WikiLeaks also disclosed the war logs, which are 90,000 reports or more civilian casualties by coalition forces than the U.S. military had admitted to in Afghanistan. And its revelations additionally included the Guantanamo files, 779 secret reports showing that 150 innocent people had been held there for years, and documenting the torture and abuse of 800 men and boys in violation of the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment. WikiLeaks also published the notorious Collateral Murder video, which documented how in 2007, a U.S. Army Apache helicopter gunship targeted and fired on unarmed civilians in Baghdad. At least 18 civilians were killed. They included two Reuters reporters and a man who came to rescue the wounded. Two children were injured. Then a U.S. Army tank drove over one of the bodies, severing it in half. That video contains evidence of three separate war crimes that are prohibited by the Geneva Conventions and the U.S. Army Field Manual. As several civil liberties and human rights organizations declared in October 2021, when they asked Garland to dismiss the case against Assange, his prosecution poses a significant threat to First Amendment freedom of the press. The UK's decision to extradite Julian Assange to the nation that plotted to assassinate him, the nation that wants to imprison him for 175 years for publishing truthful information in the public interest, is an abomination, wrote Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, and Alice Walker, co-chairs of Assange Defense, in reaction to Petel's extradition order. The U.S. government argues that its venerated constitution does not protect journalism the government dislikes and that publishing truthful information in the public interest is a subversive criminal act. This argument is a threat not only to journalism but to democracy itself. Trevor Tim, Executive Director of Freedom of the Press Foundation, warned that if Assange is extradited to the United States and convicted of the charges against him, it would potentially make receiving classified information, asking for sources for more information, and publishing certain types of classified information a crime. Tim noted, journalists, of course, engage in all these activities regularly. Moreover, Assange has suffered psychological torture while confined in the UK for more than a decade, according to Nils Meltzer, United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture. In December 2021, Meltzer tweeted that the UK is literally torturing him to death. On June 10th, more than 300 doctors, psychiatrists, and psychologists calling themselves Doctors for Assange wrote to Petel that Assange's deteriorating health made it medically and ethically unacceptable to extradite him. Julian's 13-year persecution culminates in a decision of ostentatious, callous indifference, John Shipton, Assange's father, told Truthout, adding, "Who amongst us would not burn with indignation and loathing?" Estelle Assange, who recently married Julian in prison, called Petel's decision a dark day for press freedom and for British democracy. She told the Associated Press, "Julian did nothing wrong. He has committed no crime and is not a criminal. He is a journalist and a publisher, and he is being punished for doing his job." Yet UK officials disregarded Assange's health and the injustice of his prosecution, insisting that the US would treat him appropriately. In its June 17th statement ordering Assange's extradition, the UK Home Office wrote, "In this case, the UK courts have not found that it would be oppressive, unjust, or an abuse of process to extradite Mr. Assange, nor have they found that extradition would be incompatible with his human rights, including his right to a fair trial and to the freedom of expression, and that whilst in the US, he will be treated appropriately, including in relation to his health." But after a three-week evidentiary hearing, UK District Judge Vanessa Baritzer ruled in January 2021 that if Assange were extradited to the United States, he would likely attempt suicide because of his mental state and the onerous conditions of confinement in US prisons. The United States later came forward with qualified assurances that Assange wouldn't be kept in solitary confinement, and the UK High Court reversed Barrister's decision in January 2022. The UK Supreme Court affirmed the High Court's dismissal of Assange's appeal in March, paving the way for Patel's decision ordering extradition. Amnesty International Agnes Callamard, former UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Execution, was skeptical of the so-called assurances that Assange would be treated humanely in U.S. custody. Diplomatic assurances provided by the U.S. that Assange will not be kept in solitary confinement cannot be taken on face value given previous history, Callamard said, referring to the U.S. reneging on past extradition assurances. Assange now has until July 1st to appeal Patel's decision and apply to the High Court to reverse Barrister's ruling on the other issues Assange raised on the extradition hearing. Assange will also raise on appeal the CIA's plot to kidnap and assassinate him while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy under a grant of asylum. If Assange loses his appeals to the UK High Court and Supreme Court, he could appeal to the European Court of Human Rights. The appeals could take several months or even years. The indictment against Assange has been assigned to U.S. District Judge Claude M. Hilton, who jailed former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning in 2019 for refusing to appear before a federal grand jury investigating Assange. The indictment charges that Assange conspired with Manning to gain access to a government computer. This is the first time the United States has prosecuted a journalist or media outlet for publishing classified information. The extradition, trial, and conviction of Julian Assange would have frightening ramifications for investigative journalism. On June 17th, the editorial board of The Guardian wrote, "This action potentially opens the door for journalists anywhere in the world to be extradited to the U.S. for exposing information deemed classified by Washington."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.